we go back to 2 Kings chapter 2, verse number 19, and continue with the story of Elisha, the new leader of the sons of the prophets in the northern kingdom of Israel. Elijah has just been taken away by God in a whirlwind, and now Elisha bears all of that supernatural ability, that prophetic leadership that his predecessor had. And the first place that he is seen exercising that is at Jericho, first down at the rivers of the Jordan, a few miles away, where he slaps Elijah's mantle, which is now his mantle, on the Jordan River, and it opens up and lets him walk across on dry land. Now he's at the city of Jericho, which is a new city. The city was rebuilt after being in ruins for many hundreds of years. It was just rebuilt under in the time of King Ahab, who's recently passed. And so there is a school of the prophets here, a little headquarters for some of these students of Elisha and now Elijah. So verse number 19, the men of the city, that is Jericho, said to Elisha, "Behold, the situation of this city is pleasant, as my Lord sees." And it is. It's a very nice situation. It's nice and warm all year round. The soil is very fertile. And it's near crossroads of traffic going north and south and east and west. It does have water from a perpetual spring right there, about 5 or 6 miles west of the Jordan, just below the cliffs, just below the sudden uprising of the hills up toward Judah and Benjamin to the west. But the water has a problem. They said the water's bad, and so the land is unfruitful. Now, way back when Jericho was first built, it was built here because of that water supply. But then when Jericho was destroyed, a curse was put on the site, and nobody was supposed to rebuild here. The water may have been impacted by that curse, and that's why this place has not been green for a good long time. But we end up with this happening. After the people in the city say, "Can you help us out?" Elisha said, "Well, bring me a new bowl," so a brand new throne bowl, "and put salt in it." So they brought it to him. And then he went to the spring of water, which we know where that spring's at, and he threw salt in it. So he just dumps that salt right into the spring out of that brand new bowl. Now, is that how you fix bad water? No. I've had water softeners where you have salt that you put in it, but it's intended to soften the water. It doesn't change the taste of the water to make it from bad to good. We have filters for that sort of thing. So this is not a natural mechanism to fix the water. This is something emblematic. This is something symbolic that God's Spirit told Elisha to do as an illustration of how God was going to fix the issue. And so he threw the salt in it, and then he said, "Thus says he who is, I have healed this water. From now on, neither death nor miscarriage shall come from it." So apparently it was bad enough that they believed that it had caused deaths and had caused miscarriages over time. And then we have the testimony of the prophet writer. "So the water has been healed to this day, according to the word that Elisha spoke." And it's remained that way. That water is quite sufficient for the needs even of the modern community of the city of Jericho. It's in the Palestinian territories. It's not Israeli territory per se. And if you go on like satellite maps like Google Earth, you'll see there's a nice green zone in this area by Jericho that is brought about because of the water from that spring. And God's the one that did it through the prophet Elisha here, I think, right around 862 BC. So quite some time ago. So now he's done at Jericho. He needs to go back to some of the other places where there are schools of the prophets. Verse 23, he went up from there to Beth-El. So good day's travel, probably. Now, while he was going up on the way, so somewhere along the road, probably coming close to Jericho, some small boys. Now, the word means young, that's true, but it doesn't necessarily mean like little bitty elementary kids or preschoolers. My guess is we're talking about teenagers here. So they are not counted as full-grown men, which in Jewish cultural understanding was 20. So these are probably teenagers. And so they came out of the city of Bethel, evidently, and they jeered at him, saying, "Go up, you bald head! Go up, you bald head!" Now, when I've heard this taught when I was a kid, I always heard the focus being put on the fact that they were calling him baldy. But that's not really what the issue is here. Remember that he has just brought back testimony as the only eyewitness of the departure of Elisha and said, he went up into the sky. God caught him up into the heavens. He just disappeared up. That's what they're mocking here. The baldy part is, it's a bonus as far as these troublesome teenagers are. They are mocking his story about the departure of Elijah. Why don't you go up, baldy? Why don't you join Elijah in the sky? And that is why he puts a curse on them. Verse 24, he turned around, and when he saw them, he cursed them in the name of he who is. So basically, God, deal with them. And two she-bears came out of the woods and tore 42 of the boys. Now, it doesn't say that these bears killed them. I know that's another thing that people have claimed when they were telling the story when I was younger, and I've heard it since then. I don't see anything about their death here. I see them getting mauled bad enough by these bears that they might remember it for the rest of their life, that you don't go around mocking the word of the prophet of the Lord. When he says Elijah went up into the sky, you better believe it. 42, that's a lot of them. That's quite the little gang that was going on causing him trouble. And then presumably, he went to Bethel and spent some time with the sons of the prophets there. Verse 25, from there he went on to Mount Carmel. Now, Mount Carmel, we know, had an altar where the contest between the prophets of Baal and Elijah took place. It may be that there's a school of the prophets either at that site, although Mount Carmel is a very long ridgeline. It's not like a peak. The little bump you see on the maps of Israel that goes out into the Med, that little bump is the northwest end of the ridgeline of Mount Carmel. It's about 35 miles long, technically, the whole thing. Megiddo is actually part of the ridgeline of Mount Carmel. So somewhere on that ridgeline, I'm guessing there must be another school of the prophets located. And that's where he checks in. And then from there, he returned to Samaria. That is probably to the city of Samaria, in order to check in with the school of prophets that might have been there as well. 2 Kings chapter 3, we have to skip the first few verses because that deals with events we're not ready for just yet, or things that we've already done, looks like maybe. Go to verse 6 instead. Verse number 6. So, King Jehoram, he's the new king of the Israelis, because King Ahaziah, remember, has died. King Jehoram marched out of the city of Samaria at that time, and he mustered all of Israel. And what we'll discover is that Elisha, and I noticed I did it already, and I warned you about this, Elisha and Elijah's names are so close, I'll sometimes mix them up without even realizing I did it. And so you just need to adjust that in your own head if you hear me do it. So Elisha apparently tags along behind this army as it's leaving the capital city of Samaria. Now, where is it going? Well, it's heading south, and along the way, the king is going to try to pick up some assistance from the king of southern Judah, Jehoshaphat. Why? Because it's the spring of the year now, and it is time to deal with the rebellion of the Moabites that's mentioned up in verse number 4. When King Ahab died the previous year, these guys decided they weren't going to send any more of their wool tribute to northern Israel out of Moab. And so now King Jehoram, one of the first things he wants to take care of is bring Moab to heel, bring them back under the control of northern Israel, and get that tribute wool being brought back into the kingdom's coffers. Verse number 7. So he went and he sent word to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to battle against Moab?" Now, Jehoshaphat's son, who is also named Jehoram, is married to Athaliah, who is the sister of King Jehoram, this guy right here, and the new king of Israel. So Jehoshaphat is tied by marriage to this new king of northern Israel. And so his response is, "I'll go. I'm as you are. My people are your people. My horses as your horses." Now, Jehoshaphat might also have a reason for doing this, because remember, earlier, the Moabites and some Ammonites and apparently some people of Mount Seir had tried to invade his country, and they ended up being taken care of by God, so their invasion failed. And so it may be that Jehoshaphat feels, yeah, we can take care of this together to make sure we don't have any of that happen again. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I think that Jehoshaphat has not learned his lesson yet, that he needs to quit having anything to do with northern Israel. He got chewed out for being at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead and almost getting himself killed. He got chewed out for building ships and planning on going on trade sailing expeditions with the next king, Ahaziah, from northern Israel. And yet here we are. He is agreeing to go on maneuvers, military maneuvers, with this new king of northern Israel. And it will not, it'll turn out well for them personally, but it will not turn out well as a story completely. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Verse 8. So Jehoram, the king of northern Israel, says, by which way shall we march? Excuse me, this is Jehoshaphat that asked the question. Then Jehoram answered, by the way of the wilderness of Edom. So Jehoram of the northern country of Israel says, I want us to go down through your territory, down on the west side of the Dead Sea, and then cut across into Edom. Why Edom? Because Edom is in close alliance with Judah. Verse number 9. So the king of Israel went with the king of Judah and the king of Edom. So the king of Edom is a client king of Judah right now. So they're going to swing south of the Dead Sea, get themselves all organized there in Edom, and then swing back north and then cross a wadi, a river, and invade southern Moab. So that's the plan. When they had made a circuitous route or march of 7 days, so that includes all the time that they're going down the western side of the Sea of Galilee, and then the time they spend in Edom getting themselves organized there, and then crossing up into Moab. So that's 7 days total. There was no water for the army or for the animals that follow them. So what they find is, in this part of the areas, it is dry. Everything's dried up. It's apparently summertime by now. And you got to have water or you can't survive very long. This is really rugged territory. The Dead Sea area, of course, you know, is very dry and brown and not much life in it. Very scrubby, whatever trees or foliage there is. When you go over into Edom and then into southern Moab, it's kind of in the shadow of that desert area. So it doesn't get tons of rain either. So everything's dried up. And they got a problem. Verse 10, then the king of Israel said, alas, he who is has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. So immediately Jehoram, the king of northern Israel, says, apparently Yahweh brought us all out here to die. Jehoshaphat's response is there no prophet of he who is here, through whom we may inquire of he who is? So, once again, the southern king, the king of southern Judah, a righteous man, a believer in the true and living God, a worshiper of the true and living God, he's hanging out with people that are not worshipers of the true God. And these guys are all in despair, and figuring everything's lost, and if it's anybody's fault, it's the fault of he who is. It's the fault of Yahweh. And Jehoshaphat is, come on, don't we have any prophets with us from the true and living God that can tell us what we're supposed to do next? My question is, why doesn't he have one of the prophets of southern Judah with him? Or is it, you know, that none of them wanted to go with him? I don't know. But then we find out what I already told you. Elisha's been tagging along. Then one of the king of Israel's servants said, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who poured water on the hands of Eliyahu. That's meaning he was his personal servant, his intimate servant. He helped him go through his washing ceremonies on a regular basis. So he's here. He's nearby. And so Jehoshaphat said, oh, the word of he who is with him. Now, he doesn't know him personally, but he knows about him. And so the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. So the impression I get is that Elisha has tagged along, and so he's got his own little encampment somewhere near where these guys are camping out. And so they go to that encampment, the three of them, the three leaders, and they're seeking his guidance. So Elisha said to the king of Israel, that's Jehoram, the bad guy, what have I to do with you? Why don't you go to the prophets of your father and to the prophets of your mother? That would be Ahab and Jezebel. So we're talking about Baal, Asherah, which this guy no doubt worships. But the king of Israel said to him, no, it is he who has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. Now, that's interesting. Apparently, somewhere in this whole process, Jehoram got the impression that he was supposed to go in the name of he who is and force Moab to come back under the leadership of the northern Israeli kingdom, and that Jehoshaphat, who serves he who is, was supposed to be involved in this whole process. Now, I'm not sure where he got that understanding, but I would remind you that his father died because he who is wanted him to be in a certain place at a certain time fighting a certain battle. And so, interesting that we've got Jehoram saying, no, we're here because Yahweh told us to be here. You're Yahweh's prophet. You need to help us out. Verse 14. Elisha said, as he who is over the armies, Yahweh Tzabaoth is the Hebrew, as the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, were it not that I have regard for Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would neither look at you nor see you. Wow, that is rough. That's straight up talk right there. So this guy is so bad that the prophet says, if you were here on your own, I wouldn't even be talking to you. I wouldn't even look at you. Verse 15. But now, bring me a musician. So for the sake of the believing king, get me an accompanist. Because remember that prophets often sang their prophecies. When the musician played, the hand of he who is came upon him. And he said, or sang, thus says he who is, I will make this dry stream bed full of pools. For thus says he who is, you shall see not see wind or rain, but that stream bed shall be filled with water, so that you shall drink, you, your livestock, and your animals. So he prophesies water being provided miraculously. This is a light thing in the sight of he who is. So that's no big deal for God. He will also give the Moabites into your hands, and you shall attack every fortified city, every choice city, and shall fell every good tree, and stop up all springs of water, and ruin every good piece of land with stones. So basically, Moab is now coming under God's judgment, and these guys are going to be involved in executing that judgment. Now, the first part of this comes to pass immediately the next morning. The next morning, about the time of the offering of the sacrifice, that's the morning sacrifice, behold, water came from the direction of Edom. That's to the south of where they're at. Now, did God make rain fall down there overnight, and then that water is now flowing into where they're at here to the north? Maybe, although they were told that they wouldn't see rain perhaps not even at a distance? Is it possible God just miraculously brought up springs of water in all the wadis to the south and provides that? Yeah, that's no problem at all for him. I mean, that's how he provided water for the Israelis the whole time they were in the wilderness. But how he ever provides this miraculously, the water comes from the direction of Eden till the country was filled with water. So there's water everywhere now, pools everywhere. Now, when all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, all who were able to put on armor, from the youngest to the oldest, were called out, and they were drawn up at the border. So these guys are coming south to deal with an invasion. When they got up early on this morning, the sun was shining on all that water, the early morning sun, which makes the water look red. And so the Moabites saw the water opposite them, in front of them, as red as blood. Now, there had been no rain. They knew it was totally dry. And so the only red that they figure would show up suddenly overnight has got to be blood. And so they said, "This is blood. The kings have surely fought together and struck one another down." Now remember, not too long ago, some of the Moabites had died in a similar fashion, fighting with the Ammonites and fighting with some people from Mount Seir. And so these guys, this part that wasn't involved in that earlier story, they assume, well, maybe the same thing happened to them. But when they came to the camp of Israel, that is, come down to spoil it, the Israelites rose and struck the Moabites till they fled before them, and they went forward striking the Moabites as they went. So instead of finding dead bodies and lots of loot, these guys walked straight into an ambush.